One of my specialties is going upstairs to get something and then just ending up in a room and being like, what am I doing here?
Welcome, everybody, to episode 225 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm just happy to be here.
I'm Sam, and I'm the artist with no voice.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. And today is Slap Tumblr Funky Plate 2019. And we're coming at you live from Shenanicon 2019. Okay.
As you can hear, there are thousands.
Just trillions.
Thousands of people in this room.
All right. And we also have a warning. There's going to be profanity in this show. So, you know, just deal with that however you got to. And this is a bit of a special episode because we are here at Shenanicon and we don't want to waste your time with nonsense like stories from our lives or talking about the games industry. We just want to hear from you guys. So we're just going to jump right into questions.
Let's do it.
I think.
And specifically questions from people at Shenanicon.
That's right. So the first question comes from Isaac Bear, also known as Angry Muffin.
Also known as Angry. There's a microphone kind of
microphone's over there. Yeah, just it's in the darkness,
show
so you can
how
just
it's done.
Stumble your way to it, and you get it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like going back to Scuttlebutt? You're still going working. How hard was Label?
I think Seth can speak to the latter part of that quickly.
Yeah, so it was actually pretty easy to get it playable. My concern was that there were a few like weird settings I had to tweak, and the big thing was that during the capture game in Scuffle Buddies, where you capture a new buddy to add to your battle kit, we just had some placeholder Pokemon music in there, and I had to get that out before we showed that. But that was pretty much it. We left it in a decent state, I think.
Yeah, my major concern was I was like, we quit working on this for a reason. And so I was like, okay, are we going to boot this up and be like, this is not showable. You know, this is not a good idea. But actually, it was so surprising coming back to it because we couldn't remember how everything worked. And so we were like, it was actually like playing it for the first time, right? As if we were players. And so we're like, oh my God, what's that buddy called? I don't remember making them. So I'm like, okay, what was that one called? And then we'd go read the little tooltip about it and then go find recipes out in the world as if we were playing it for the first time. And so it actually got all of us really excited about making another open world game, to be honest, because it was so fun to hop back into and get that feeling of like an expanse that you know nothing about. After working on Levelhead, which is a, you know, a platformer, we're like, okay, this is exciting. I know what we want to do next.
Yeah, yeah. It was really what settled in our minds, the idea of actually deciding to do Crashlands 2, because we'd kicked around the idea maybe next thing would be Crashlands 2. Who knows? But it seemed like so big and so, I don't know, it just seemed like something we didn't necessarily want to do. Yeah. But then having played Scuffle Buddies and seeing what it could look like again, we're just very excited.
I think the best part was there's a thing you can do in Scuffle Buddies. We didn't show this during the presentation, but you guys can do it on the demo. There's a thing you can do where there's these weird plants in the world. I think we just called them popcorn.
Yeah.
But they're just like a weird tall plant thing. And you can use your whack jangler to get popcornels off of them. And if you bring a popcornel to the town bonfire, you can pop it. And then that goes in your inventory. And then that's another one of those like, what is this for? And I think you can get some kind of liquid and mix it with a popcornel or pop.
You can make a tortilla.
To make a tortilla. And I don't know if we ever did anything with that tortilla, but it's in there. So yeah, we had a lot of like weird discoveries and things that you can just kind of find and figure out. So yeah, it was really exciting to kind of do. Our next question comes from C. Price. And also we can ask or read the questions ourselves. So you don't have to come up to Mike if you don't want to. So, all right. C. Price asks, if you could have one level head power up in real life, which would it be? Depends on the context, right?
It does. That's why you need all of them.
Being able to punch something real hard, I don't really know when that's useful.
It's going to be expensive. I feel like you're going to rack up a lot of insurance.
Actually, that's true, because you can't even use it to move furniture or anything.
Nah.
It's gone now. Just gone. I think probably the best one to get out of social situations would be the rebound. You know, if a The face comes out of your head,
and you go flying back.
You also just fly away. I feel like that's a really sort of punctual way to just get out of a conversation.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So I feel like the tiptoe might be a more adequate thing because you can just turn into a bush and then you're done. Like no one's going to talk to you anymore. You can.
I'm assuming that video game logic still applies, right? So like you'll be at an awkward social interaction or something. Mm-hmm. You're like, I gotta get out of here. You just become a bush. The person you're speaking with is like, I can't
see you anymore.
I don't know. I don't know.
And they immediately forget that you even existed.
They're like, I guess I'll just go about my day.
Or they start sleeping, which is what the enemies do. They're like, turn to bush. I guess I'm done now.
Yes. And obviously the zipper is going to be great for commuting.
Yeah. And theft. Also very good for theft.
Yeah, we actually had some issues setting up a Shenanicon because the front door locks from it just locks, period. And we are, for some reason, our building keys don't work on just that door. Of all the doors in the building, we can't open the door to get into this very event. So we had some struggles with that. It'd be nice if I could just teleport. That would be a good
thing. Or punch the door off of it.
Just punch it right up.
There are many ways.
Yeah. So I guess all of them.
Yeah.
Can't pick one. They're like your children, right? All right. Next question comes from Ben Clark.
So are there any productivity tools that you've tried but have decided against using in the long run?
Ooh.
Many. We talk about these a lot on the podcast throughout the years. I think what haven't we tried? I don't know. We've honestly tried anytime we've heard of a new tool, we used to pick them up and drop them just constantly. And we have kind of settled finally into a handful of tools. But we've tried everything. We've tried things that keep you on task for 20 minutes at a stretch.
That was a Pomodoro timer. If you guys have heard of that concept.
Yeah. So the Pomodoro technique is where you set a timer for 25 minutes. You work for 25 minutes and then the timer goes off and you're supposed to take like a 5 minute, stretch, do some jumping jacks or something.
Yeah. I feel like in a lot of cases, productivity tools, it's one of those things that you can use it to make it feel like you're really doing stuff. When really, if you had just sat down and done the dang thing, instead of like trying to figure out elaborate ways to time yourself, you probably would have been just fine either way. Yeah. But I think what they're useful for is just getting you sort of back on track. Cause I honestly can't think of any, productivity tool I've used or software I've used and then just sort of like kept using, except for something like Trello, which we use for team-based collaboration. But like there's a program called Toggle, which you can use to track your time. And that's really, really useful right up until you get a pretty good sense of how much time you're spending on things. And then tracking it just becomes sort of an exercise in redundancy.
Well, you also have to track how much time you're using.
Toggling. Yeah.
Which turns out to be a lot. Yeah, that's the thing with a lot of these productivity tools, right? And even strategies is if you get obsessed with them. I don't know if y'all remember back when Lifehacker was in its heyday. I don't know if that's a thing y'all were into. But I used to read that website just constantly. Every time they had a new tip, a new tool, I would be doing
it. I remember that phase of your life.
Yeah, I spent so much time being productive that I didn't produce anything.
Yeah.
That's the curse.
You're like, I'm just laying the foundation. Just getting ready.
It is very risky.
So when I first met my wife, I remember she saw me one day. I had my whiteboard going and I had a bunch of lists and I was reading a book about how to make lists. And she was just always doing things. And she asked me one day, she was like, do you think maybe you're focusing too much on the system for getting this done and not just like, doing it? And I think the reality for me was recognizing that at some point there definitely is a threshold where productivity enhancement becomes a form of entertainment for you, where you're like, ooh, yeah, we can get like 1% more out of this next thing. And the reality is setting it up, getting to know the tool, all this stuff takes so much more energy. And there's kind of just a few basic rules that if you have a calendar, if you have the ability to manage lists of tasks in an effective way, and then some way to help you ease into work. So things like Pomodoro techniques, anything like that, that lets you get over that initial sort of inertia problem, then I think you're basically set. Like you can keep on adding stuff on that, but it's not going to get tons of add on top of it.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that using a productivity tool or starting to use one in itself just has value because you're changing some stuff, which kind of forces you to think more about the things that you're doing?
I think that's so.
Probably,
I think the interesting thing,
what it really is.
Yeah, you can't use a tool without yourself being changed, right? is the interesting part about it. And so I think even when we talk about Toggle, right? If you use Toggle for a week or two and then drop it, I think the reality is you will get a better sense, at least for a short period of time, of how it is you're using your time and how it is you're putting energy into things. And so if you, as long as you can carry that forward,
then which you will for a while.
Yeah. I think, the tool can live inside of you.
Just forever.
Just forever. And so I do think there's definitely a certain level where if you do this sort of, entertainment productivity thing, there is some level actually where if you use a bunch of these tools, then they're all different lenses, right, to view the work from. And I remember the first, it's like DevOps, right? We talk about DevOps a lot, but the first time using that sort of a structure, that sort of a system, really shines a light, not just on your work life, but also other aspects. And so I do think there's good reasons to explore, but I think you got to recognize when you're just exploring versus like being productive and don't blend the two together and fool yourself.
And there are two sides of it too. I think when we talk about productivity, we're almost always focused on how do I organize my work and how do I make myself do it, right? Those are the two pieces. Yeah. But the more important piece is how do I make doing it easier? Like the actual act of doing the work, because the reason it's so easy to get distracted is because it's hard to do work, right? Mm-hmm. And the better your tools are for doing the work itself, the less distracted you become, the faster you get your work done anyway, the less it even matters if you actually have trouble staying on task because you can get more done. And so I think it's one of those interesting phenomena that it becomes easy to obsess about making yourself work rather than the doing of it. So that's what I know me personally, I've moved away from that one stage I had back in the day of just obsessing about how do I efficiently get to work, right? And organize my work. And now I obsess about how do I make the work as easy as possible to do.
A funny example of this is last week. So we bought new computer processors because Seth was experiencing this burn where every time he built Levelhead to test something, it would take
about 3.5 minutes.
Right? Which is just too long. Like if you're testing a few things, you have to wait 3.5 minutes every single time.
If you don't program, that might not sound like a long time, but it's
if you just sat at your computer and you couldn't do anything.
And you just stared at it for 3.5 minutes.
And it's using 100% of the CPU. You're not using that computer. You're just sitting there doing nothing.
Yep. And the best part was, so Adam and Seth were like, this is ridiculous. We need faster processors. So we buy new processors and they're like, cool, we're going to swap these in this morning. It's going to be super easy. Open up the computers, rip everything out, get the processor ripped out, and then it doesn't work with the new one. We're not quite. Check everything. They're running various BIOS checks and doing all sorts of things. Still doesn't work. And then they go look at the motherboard specifications. It turns out that a very new processor just doesn't work with the motherboard. So about 5.5 hours of a day nuked, right? Mm-hmm. In the effort to save
some time.
Yep. So then we order new parts. Week later, do it again, Friday, everything gets going. I think you still had some trouble getting
it. What ended up happening was my processor was also just broken. So then I had to go buy another one from Micro Center. So lost the whole day to that.
So we lost 2 days trying to speed up a 3-minute compile time.
It worked, though.
It's a parable about productivity and the dangers of external factors. But life is much better now.
Yeah, and now it takes about 2 minutes. So just really very wonderful. Good.
Over the course of the next year, we're going to get that day back.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Compile enough times, you're good. All right, so next question is going to come from Kyle Gibbs.
All right, so I couldn't remember if somebody already asked this or not, but if you had the time or the want, what would be the second Butterscotch Shenanigans podcast?
Like the sequel?
Yeah.
Or an alternate podcast.
Like, I was thinking different topic, but I mean, if you could pull off a sequel, I mean, different, that'd be fine too.
I think I would want to go deep into the tech, because we sort of designed this podcast to be one that we get nerdy about stuff, as is pretty obvious by the discussion, right? But we don't get really into it, so we don't talk about the guts of algorithms that we're struggling with. We don't talk about the guts of GameMaker. We don't talk at all really about web dev.
It's sort of a guts-free podcast.
It's a guts-free – it's all about our guts. It's not about the guts of the game. So what I would want to do is actually just one where we really got into stuff.
I have been doing some streaming on Twitch where I do, just building a game in GameMaker. And that's a really good platform for doing those kinds of things because you can actually show, what's happening and show the kinds of problems that you're dealing with. But we do just get a lot of questions from people through the Discord or even through the podcast thing, which are really, really technical.
Yeah.
About pathfinding or AI or some really weird sort of niche thing about GameMaker or web development or something. And man, that just doesn't make for good radio at all.
Well, it does if everyone's on board. You know, if everyone's signed up,
that's what you're here for.
Yeah, I listen to a whole bunch of developer podcasts that a normal person wouldn't listen to. Yeah. But I've opted in and I love it and it's great, right? And this is too much of a variety podcast for.
Yeah, well, I think the interesting thing about the question is that the subtext of it is sort of like what are your hobbies that you have enough knowledge or interest in that you would want to share. I think the funny thing is probably that most of us do the work in the studio and then we either we're working on our skills or knowledge in some domain that's very related always. I think if we could do a cast that had more of a design specific bent to it or on the business side. The problem is that we can't talk about most of the interesting business stuff. It's all under NDA. So,
And even when we can, we don't want to throw people under the bus.
Yeah. You can't be like, let me tell you about this company. Yeah. That's not going to be good. So I don't know. I think a bit more of a design focused one, I think would be really fun.
Option B, we make a podcast about us trying to figure out how to have hobbies.
That's the new thing.
Actually, that could be.
I've been watching a lot of the Great British Bake Show. Maybe we could have.
Now you got to start doing it.
Yeah, have a podcast about that.
We could also have an ARC podcast where we just play ARC.
Just tell stories.
Tell stories.
We did have some mini-sodes of that sort of woven through that. I don't know. That's something that I've kind of struggled with is this question of making games was my hobby before it was my career. And honestly, even to this day, even though it's been almost a decade, I just don't know what to do with myself when I leave work. And I've tried all kinds of other things and nothing just quite sort of grabs me the same way that game programming does. Like I've tried tinkering with Arduino and doing some other things, and I'm just like, I'd just rather just go make a game. So that's a struggle.
Yeah,
I don't know, but it would be a good podcast.
Yeah,
struggling through that. All right, next question comes from Quantum Anomaly, Brett Lindley.
Do you find it difficult to come up with something like, say, a podcast question when you feel like you're being put on the spot, or do you guys operate better under pressure?
All right, real quick, what's your favorite joke?
No, I'm just kidding. Actually, really inappropriate.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the thing. So like, all of us have gotten really quite good at the sort of public speaking aspect of this from just sitting in a room with each other every week for an hour. I think it's the case that, if it's the sort of the problem of if you're a comedian or something like that and someone sort of shows up and they're like, be funny. Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't set the mood appropriately for you to be able to hop in.
Also, it feels like they're determined to not
enjoy it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I don't like that.
So I think as far as coming up with things on the fly, I mean, we've done it in game jams now. We've done it in a lot of these contexts. But the truth is, like, I still prefer to have a little bit of breathing room. Not a lot, but just a little bit. Because I think usually it's the second or third idea that comes out. And if you have that external pressure to get something good on the first try, it can be a little bit more nerve-wracking. And I think it hides some of the really good stuff underneath. But I don't know.
I mean, I kind of like to just go off the cuff.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, there's some stress involved, right? Because now you gotta do something. But on the other hand, now you did it. You just said something,
Good job.
This is what's happening in this very moment. Is I'm just trying to answer this question. I'm just saying whatever it is coming out of my brain, and it's either good or bad. I mean, you guys all get to decide, right? Mm. But once I finish saying things, I just did it.
You're done now.
I don't have to worry about it anymore. I answered the question.
There's another issue with this is it's probably the case that I have a rate of idea generation. It's probably about maybe 1.3 per minute, I'd say.
Or so, yeah.
Yeah.
About right.
So if you find that on toggle. If you caught me at the wrong time, I might be on cooldown and then I can't do it.
Yeah.
So it can be kind of tricky. All right, next question comes from Adam Meisenheimer.
Right. So Google announced their PlayPass system this week. They stated that developers will be paid according to an algorithm that incorporates time spent in the app with unknown factors to determine which titles, quote, bring the highest user value. How do you expect this approach to change the mobile game ecosystem?
I'm going to repeat the question a little bit or rephrase a little bit. So yeah, Google Play announced this new subscription service. Mm-hmm. And they want to pay developers based on some secret algorithm, but which probably really factors in how much time users are spending in the app. So what does this mean? What's it going to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the important thing here is that, and especially the thing we've learned from Levelhead, is that we do a bit of our own algorithmic curation of levels, right? So if you've ever tried to play the tower trial in Levelhead, that's done by an algorithm trying to pick some of the best stuff. And if you've played it, you know that we sometimes can't tell what the best stuff is.
Yeah. We pick the worst stuff.
Sometimes we pick the worst stuff or the impossible stuff. And the reality is that we're using similar metrics as something like playtime to measure things like engagement in an algorithm like that. The major problem with this sort of approach is that it suggests that you're going to be able to get at quality, sort of quality with a capital Q, by looking at a series of metrics about a game. And I don't know about you guys, but I think it's generally the case that feel and sort of the overall experience of a game is nearly impossible to capture from data that you get about that game. So you can't necessarily, you really can't read engagement with a game in a super effective way. And so we end up sort of falling back on these techniques, which are like, how long are people playing it? How many times do they open it? So you want to know why you get push notifications all the time. It's because guess what? If a game gets opened a lot by a lot of users, it will get algorithmically boosted, right? We know this is sort of like a lot of the ways these stores work because it's a measure of engagement. Whether or not that's actually you enjoying yourself or enjoying the game or whatever else is kind of moot. In fact, it's irrelevant. If a game like Crashlands never asks you to open it ever, what does that mean? Are we sort of at a disadvantage now in terms of the algorithms? So I think there's a ton of problems with trying to do this algorithmic curation. We've actually seen these across all the storefronts already. It's neat that they're trying another method largely for premium developers to be able to make some money because, frankly, the mobile space is rough in that regard right now. But I don't know that there's going to ever be a solution that involves really, quote, good algorithmic stuff that then the algorithm determines how much we get paid. Yeah. That just never seems like a
thing. Well, you can't because you can't tell whether somebody is playing something a lot because they're getting deep, personal enjoyment out of it, or because it's got addictive mechanics in it. You can't tell the difference.
Or maybe it's bothering them every 5 minutes.
Yeah, or reminds them that they exist.
Yeah.
But the end result of this, though, is, as the end of that question suggested, people will design for the algorithm. That's mm-hmm. that's just how this works. Because
look at YouTube, for example. Huh? Yes. Every thumbnail has one of those dumb red circles with an arrow pointing at it. Because then you're like, what is that? And then you click on it. It's because it works.
It's clickbait.
It's sort of the thing. Yeah. And if the algorithm that actually pays you is one where you need to get your players just to be in the app as much as possible, and that's the main thing, and get them spending as much as possible and so on, then that's going to dictate the kind of games that can be successful and therefore the kind of games that get made. Mm-hmm. But we already see this in all the stores because it is already the case that all the stores push your game up the charts, the more money it makes. The more people visit it from outside the store, the more times people boot it up, the more likely they are to spend money if they have just recently played your game and so on and so forth. So we're already living in that world, actually, where the people have to design their games around the ways that games make money.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you can't survive. But also, it's just sort of a circular problem, right? The ones that are successful are the ones that design that way. So there's also the only ones that you see. All the rest are in the bottom of the charts with the masses, right? We already live in that world.
Yeah, I recall.
I'm not sure it's even going to get worse.
When we first started working on Crashlands, we spoke to various publishers and stuff, and there was a lot of apprehension about the fact that people only play mobile games for 3 minutes at a time was the quote that kept sort of coming back to us all the time. If you open up just about any mobile game, you will find that, weird, they're all designed to only be played for 3 minutes at a time. So it creates this really bizarre kind of self-reinforcing sort of feedback loop. And of course, people design their games this way because the algorithms will look for those kinds of engagement metrics. And so I think, but coming back to the end of this question of like, how will this change the mobile gaming ecosystem? Probably not at all.
No, I don't think so.
Because I think it's already doing all that
stuff. Yeah, well, because the really important note here is that the interesting reality is that what this means is it's basically an admission by Google Play that the algorithm that they were using to surface games does not work for premium games, which is true. It is 100% true.
Well, because, this is also what Apple Arcade was.
Yeah, they don't measure the same things. And so my problem with them saying, we have this other algorithm we made that will determine how much you get paid as a premium game. And I'm like, your other one didn't work. Why on earth would this one work? Yeah. Because you're not getting any new data from this at all. So I highly doubt it.
And this is why this is why I prefer the systems that Apple Arcade and Xbox are using, where they just say, we're going to give you this much money. That's it. You can take it or leave it. We're going to give you this much money, and we're going to have your game on the platform, and we're going to let our users have it, right?
Yeah, you can work with that.
Yeah, you can work with that. Because now you know what's going to happen. You don't have to design your game around how that's going to work in that market. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that that's the only way that those things work, because as far as we know, there are potentially additional mechanisms at play. But the core one, at least, is that you can just get paid to play your game on that platform. And I think with all these open markets that now exist, with Steam and with the mobile stores were before we had these subscription services, there's just no incentive for the platform holders to pay you, mm-hmm. right? Because they get infinite free content. They just get to have all the games, and then they just get 30% of whatever people actually spend on those things, right? So there's no incentive really for them to do it. And we're just lucky that there are still a few holdouts that do, because those are the only places left, I think, where you can really design your game the way that you want it to be and the way that you want to engage players, so that you can have exact engagement. If you want to make a game that just freaks people out, like it's a super spooky horror game, right? Mm-hmm. And makes most people not want to play it ever again, right?
Yeah, maybe they want to play it once.
They want to play it once, yeah. Because that kind of a game can't live on most of the stores in their current format, but it can live inside of these very specific kinds of places where you can get paid up front for your
game. Or a game where you're a goose and you steal someone's hat.
Yeah.
You know, not a lot of depth in that, but it is fun for a while.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, as soon as you're optimizing for algorithms, like those games just don't exist anymore. All right, next question comes from Brock Sears.
What old person things do y'all do?
Mm.
Oh, the best one is groaning whenever you get into or out of a chair.
Yeah,
I love that one. Anytime I'm bending over to pick something up, it's like, I don't think I have to do that, but
it just feels right.
It feels good.
You ever see like a pro tennis player, you know, when they whack a ball and they're just like, yeah, right? I think it's the same kind of thing. Yeah. Really drives it home.
Yeah, you really are a pro at getting out of your chair.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've been doing it for years. So.
One of my specialties is going upstairs to get something and then just ending up in a room and being like, what am I doing here? Why have I come all this way? And then there's just a lot of this staring, and then it'll sort of come, you know.
You're lucky it still comes to you.
Yeah, it takes
a while. That's a young person's game that you're talking about.
Hitting 30 this year.
Remembering things? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, mine is I just like to go home. You know, like, it's really nice. It's really nice just to be at home and then go to bed early.
Yeah,
you know, it's just great.
I don't think I've hit that that level of sort of social involvement that older people have, where they just sort of don't care about pretty much anything that's going on.
I wish I was that old.
That's the ideal point to hit.
Yeah.
It's probably not very useful for a lot of things, but it will get you out of a lot of things, which is really good.
Yeah.
All right. Next question comes from Brett Ward.
So my question, I think, kind of comes from being somebody who just does game dev as a hobby, and I'm not sure how this applies to you guys or how you come at it. But basically, what is the importance of a studio staying on brand, especially for guys like you who have an established brand? When you think of Butterscotch, you think of a certain type of game and art style and all that. And if you wanted to make like a walking simulator or something, how would you transition? Do you just have to burn the ship and start over, or what do you?
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I think, cause one of the games, so I think there's a lot of power in being able to make games from every genre. The only genre we haven't really touched yet is horror, which I would love to make a horror game. I think it'd be
our greatest. Aesthetic.
The aesthetic doesn't quite work. 2D is harder for horror games. There are some good ones, but, I think when it comes to like, if we wanted to really jump, the experience we've had actually so far with Levelhead. So as far as like Crashlands being the game that most people know our studio by, you know, Levelhead is a very different and a much harder game in a lot of ways, as far as just picking up and play. It's not like a chilled game where you just kind of chill out and have fun. You will be murdered thousands of times per hour that you play, right? And so there's even a hard jump in just that. And, you know, we did have some conversations early on where when I was working on the art, because the art's still bright, it's still cartoony and fun. And I was like, there's always this question of like, does your aesthetic match the game feel? So if the game's hard, but your aesthetic is super cute, that can either work well because it's like, oh, what a contrast, or it could not, right? Depending on the game, you can be like, this doesn't feel correct.
Yeah, I mean, compare that to Super Meat Boy, right? Which is cute, but yeah, you are just a skinless person.
You're shooting, yeah, and you're shooting blood
as you run
all over.
Yeah, it's very clear that this is a hard game and it's meant to be hard.
Yeah, and so we had a lot of questions about it, like, is there a bad matchup here with what we're doing? And I think the reality is, as far as the art style goes, is like we just kind of mix, in my case, like I just make the stuff that I think is fun to look at. And that's kind of the extent of it. And so if we ever did horror, I think we would have to figure out, we would honestly probably have to do it with the art style that we have. But that just becomes a very interesting, weird challenge at that point, and something that I think you can surprise and delight people with. So I think that where it gets really interesting is where you start meshing these things that maybe shouldn't necessarily get meshed together. And then, yeah, you just kind of burn the boats. Like, that's the reality. You know, we're almost 2 years into Levelhead development. You know, the game's going to cost a ton of money to make by the time it's done. And so you are burning the boats. Every time you spend like a year or two, it's kind of like, okay, is this going to go or not? Because we're putting everything into it, so let's roll. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, but I do think it is the case that we can't really capitalize that well on Crashlands for Levelhead.
Correct.
We can in the sense that our studio is at least somewhat established, and the most important thing is that we have connections to all the platforms so that we have people to talk to when we want to go launch on a store. But when it comes to the actual game itself, it's very hard to sell Crashlands players Levelhead. It is very hard. And you'll see if you go look at any of our YouTube videos for things that go up on anything about Levelhead, the first comments are always Crashlands 2, you know, right? Yeah. Cause that's actually what people want out of our studio. So I do think it's actually incredibly difficult to depart from your, not just depart from your branding, cause we stayed pretty on brand, but even to depart from your genre. And there was a game, I can't remember what it was now, but there was an indie title that did really, really well as, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, had a huge following, kind of one of those cult successes, you know. They launched a new game that was just nothing at all. Like, everything about it was different. Different genre, different arts. Everything about it was different. It might as well have been a different studio that made it. And they were just shocked that nobody bought the game. Like, it failed miserably. And it was coming from a really well-established studio with this, you know, huge success in their hands. And it was because they didn't understand the difficulty of rolling success forward, which is what we talk about a lot in the podcast and kind of what we've been trying to do as a studio this whole time. And we did honestly shoot ourselves in the foot a little bit.
With 100%. Yeah.
Because it wasn't Crashlands 2. Like, making Crashlands 2 is the only way we really could have done that, which is also part of why we're very excited to have that be, you know, potentially a future thing that we do.
Yeah.
I definitely agree with all that in the sense that just the aesthetic or just the vibes isn't always enough. Mm-hmm. And sequels, of course, always do incredibly well, but I think our general style of humor and all that other stuff, like we could adapt that into 3D. We could adapt that into a walking simulator. I still don't know about horror, but we could do an RTS. You know, we could do a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But the meat of a game is what you do. You know, what is the player actually doing in the game? And the difference between Crashlands and Levelhead is pretty dramatic in terms of how intense it is for people and the level of skill required to do it. So, yeah, it's been a hard sell, frankly.
It's always really interesting when you look at studios like Supergiant, I think, who does an incredible job of this, where, I mean, their games are all very different. I mean, Pyre was like a basketball, magical basketball, right? Just kind of a weird thing. But if you think about their, like, they all feel very similar, at least to me. You know, top-down view, you're controlling usually a character, sometimes three, running around. So they all have a similar level of what's going on in terms of story, polish, whatever else. So they're departing in terms of genre, but the overall sort of overarching feel, I think, tends to be pretty fluid throughout all their games. And I think if you can manage to do that, then absolutely, like, do it, because the truth is it will help you roll forward. I think we were also surprised by the extent to which it did not roll forward for Levelhead. Right? But it's just something we learned.
Yet. Yeah.
Yet.
All right. Next question comes from Alex Tosh. All right. Question is, what is the thing you found most surprising and or unexpected in any stage of development, either positive or negative, of Levelhead? Just anything. Sure.
I'm still surprised every time I finally sit down and do a thing that I should have done a long time ago, you know, and discover that it was an easy thing to do and I should have done it a long time ago.
Yeah.
Somehow still, I don't know, like, just literally 4 weeks ago, I finally attached a debugger to my Rumpus, which is the thing that runs all of our games on the website. And there were some technical things about my setup that back in the day, I was just like, oh, this will be too hard to figure out. I'll just continue doing it the stupid way. And I did that for 2 years. For 2 years. And then 4 weeks ago, I thought, you know, I should really just try to hook this up. And it took 5 minutes. It took 5 minutes to do it. And now my life has become dramatically better. Yeah, no matter what, and these kinds of things happen to me every 6 months. There's just something that I knew I should have been doing.
And the more surprising thing about that is how it never sticks.
Yes, I never learned the lesson.
Never sticks.
It's
always surprising how easy something is, and then it's surprising how you forgot that you should have just done it to begin with.
Yeah, I think for me, it's continuously surprising how you have to sort of refresh yourself every time you come to the work. Like, things have gotten easier in certain ways, but it is still not easy, if that makes sense. And it doesn't appear to be getting, it will never get easy. There's sort of a simplicity in terms of how you sit down and engage with the work once you really know what you're doing. But I think the surprise for me has been the extent to which you just have to bring your game, your personal game, every day when you come into the studio and be like, today I'm going to work really hard. Like, it has to be, like, at least for me, it has to be a thing that I'm like, I'm going to do this today. And if I don't, then I don't necessarily get a lot done. Like, you have to really focus and bring yourself to it. And I don't know why, but in my vision of, like, you know, pro people, I had always thought that when they showed up for work, when they showed up to get something done, that it was just going to come out of them. Sort of like a fountain, just like blah, just sort of vomiting out of them. And the reality is that all these people were just really good at forcing themselves to do it, you know? But there's still, all that force is still there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is going to sound kind of dumb, but I think I'm not alone in this.
We'll find out.
Which, I hope not. Okay, I need to figure out how to explain this. When I first decided that I wanted to make games, I had this really weird vision in my head about sort of what it was going to be like to be, you know, working in a game studio and doing all this stuff. And for some reason, I had this thought that there would be a point where I've done it. You know, like there'll be a moment where I look at it and be like, I did it. I'm done now. Like, I finished being a game developer. And I think this is probably,
as in, like, now you are one. Is that what you mean? Or like,
or just like, I have achieved my goal, you know, or whatever it is. Somehow not thinking about that it's just an ongoing process that you just keep doing all of the time. And I think probably you would get the same kind of a feeling if maybe you wanted to, you know, become an author, right? And you're always thinking about, like, that first book that you're going to publish or whatever it is. And you finally go and you do it, and then you're not done now. You know, like, there's now you're just getting started. And even if you do incredibly well and your book does really well, that's just the start of a whole new set of problems that you have to deal with and learn about. And it's just, there's never an end to the things that you have to learn and the things that you have to do. So there's just never a moment where you can look back or just like, and just be like, I'm done now. I've completed being an author or whatever.
It kind of feels like that staircase in Super Mario 64 where you just keep on running.
Yeah, exactly.
And you just never get up to the top. And then you turn around and you're like, what?
You look back still and you haven't moved at all.
Yeah. So it is sort of a, the further you go, the further it is very clear that you need to go, if that makes sense. And so you never, every time you're like, the goal you set for yourself back then, you hit it and you already have, you know, another 3 years of projects to do. And so it's just sort of one of those.
It just keeps going.
Which I guess is good, because otherwise we'd be bored of our mind.
You have to keep finding new things to do.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's an active decision that anybody makes of sort of like the way that you would think about what it would be like to achieve something that you want to do. It's just sort of like an implicit thought. And I think probably this comes from movies. And, you know, like, whenever you see a portrayal, stories always have like an ending point where, like, they did it, you know, they went to the moon or whatever it was. But then it ends and that's where it's done. So I don't know why that was surprising, because it really should have been obvious in retrospect. But, like, you know, it was.
There you are.
All right. Next question. And I think last question.
Finale.
It comes from Alex Garcia. I like this question.
Okay. Wait, you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. The president decides that gaming is a plague on society and makes a law that all PC gaming is banned forever. And you can now only own one gaming device, a mobile phone, a Switch, a PlayStation, or an Xbox. Which one would you choose and why?
Ooh. I like
the framing, because it feels like it fits perfectly with what would happen. You know? But I'm just going to ban the PC and it's going to take care of everything. Yeah, I think for me personally, the platform that got me weirdly enough back into playing games for a long chunk of time was the Switch, which I got last year. I played Hollow Knight. It was the first one I played on it and actually beat the game, which Hollow Knight is a giant game, by the way. So that was a lot of, you know, and a big part of it was the mobility of it. So I think it would be Switch for me.
With that. Yeah, well, I would agree. I think that still really good games are coming to Switch and like really interesting ones that don't feel, it feels less about big budget, you know, and more about just what kind of a really good, delightful experience can we make for people, which I just kind of like that about the vibe of the Switch.
Yeah, but I think there's something that we're all really missing here, which is the money-making opportunities for selling black market gaming PCs. Because as we all know, whenever you ban something,
you create a market.
It gets really expensive, and there's a lot of opportunities for organized crime.
And as we know, we're really good at building PCs.
Yeah, sometimes it takes us less than a week to install a single processor.
So you're saying you're smelling an opportunity for like a
game. I don't even care about gaming anymore. Like I'm in it for the money. Yeah.
So really you're saying we should make games exclusively for PC.
Yes.
Yes.
And then try to corner that market.
But don't tell anyone.
We make the games. We build the PCs. I figure if we really work on our processes, we could probably get 2 or 3 PCs built in a year.
Yep.
And then we sell those out on the black market.
Yeah.
Boom. We got the market cornered.
Love it.
Yeah. And of course, we probably do this from offshore because the internet exists and you can just, you know, ship stuff.
Yeah. We can just do it from Canada.
Yeah. I also like the question of lumping in mobile phones as a gaming device, because now I have to choose, like, do I get to just make phone calls or play Hollow Knight?
I would still take the Switch.
Yeah, I'd probably still take the Switch.
I think it's a net win just across
the board. Yeah, I get those phone calls and it says scam likely. You guys get those? That's like 3/4 of my calls.
That is my favorite person name.
Scam likely. Now, don't name your child Scam Likely because
it'll be confusing for future calls. Hell of a time.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. Thank you guys very much for coming to Shenanicon. We really appreciate it. It means a lot to us.
It's very humbling to have you all come here to listen to us just say nonsense.
Just saying some stuff. We, of course, would also like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster. And Jen is also in the room.
She's been holding down the front.
Oh, she's the one person not in the room. We'd also like to thank our community moderators who keep our Discord running. And I think we got some moderators here. Raise your hands, guys. Yeah. Yes, thank you very much. And of course, as always, just go to podcast.vscosh.net to ask questions and do some other stuff. Thank you all for listening.
What's that? That's the main thing.
Yeah. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for coming. And we'll see you next Shenanicon.
Goodbye. Right. Bye. Bye.